You're listening to LGRadio.online. Welcome to In the Benny Green Archives.
Johnny Mercer died on June the 25th, 1976. And in the 10 years that have passed since, I've thought a great deal about who and what he was, and why I, who hardly knew him, should have felt such a sense of personal loss. The feeling is by no means unusual. There appear to be millions who never knew him at all, who admit to having been diminished by his death, as they never were by the passing of altogether grander people, more prestigious people. Why Mercer? I suggest that the answer is with the poet Shelley. Johnny Mercer had a passing acquaintance with the poetry of Shelley, and even chose the same subject to write about once, when he wrote Skylark. But Shelley also wrote, "Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world," meaning that it's they who really provide us with the guidelines for life. Is it overstressing the case to call Mercer a poet? I think not. If the enduring qualities of what a man writes and the revelations about oneself that his work brings to us are the qualities of a poet, then that's what Mercer was. Even if the sheltered world of what are sometimes laughingly called the serious arts have never paid any attention to him. Who remembers now the much-vaunted young novelists and playwrights of Mercer's youth? Who remembers one line of their work? Who cares a fig for all those faded reputations, that long-forgotten promise which flatter to deceive? Nobody. But who has forgotten what Mercer did? How long will it be, I wonder, before the world at large decides it has had enough of all this?
Lazy bones, sitting in the sun. How you expect to get your day's work done? Never get your day's work done. Sitting in the noonday sun. So you met someone who set you back on your heat. Goody, goody, so you met someone and now you know how it feels. Hooray and hallelujah, you had it coming to you. Goody, goody for him, goody, goody for me. And I hope you're satisfied, you baddie, you. You're just too marvelous for words. That's say enough, tell enough. I mean, they just aren't swell enough. Jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those peepers? Oh, those weepers, how they hypnotize. Where'd you get those eyes? Cigarette holder, which wigs me over her shoulder. She digs me out, catting that sad dog. You must have been a beautiful baby. Must have been a wonderful child. I can see the judge's eyes as they handed you the prize. I bet you made the cutest bow. Oh, you must have been a beautiful baby. 'Cause baby, look at you now. That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In-Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. Rushing where angels fear to tread, and so I come to you, my love, my heart above my head. I remember you, you're the one who said I love you too. I do, didn't you know? day in, day out. The same old hoodoo follows me about. The same old pounding in my heart whenever I think of you. And darling, I think of you day in and day out. Dearly beloved, how clearly I see somewhere in heaven you were fashioned for me. I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you, come rain or come shine. High as a mountain and deep as a river, come rain or come shine.
What you just heard were a few fragments of American folk poetry on the wing there, a tiny part of the vast output of a highly gifted man. Johnny Mercer started off the best way. The omens were auspicious because his birth date, November the 18th, 1909, was a most distinguished one in the list of musical anniversaries. While the arrival of baby John was being celebrated in Savannah, Georgia, Mr. William Schwenk Gilbert, in his palatial home in Stanmore, was celebrating his 73rd. Gilbert, of course, was never aware of Mercer's existence, but Mercer was to be acutely aware of Gilbert's. Gilbert was to be part of his pantheon, one of the men who had shown the way. But in Savannah, Georgia, in those days, the musical background, although it incorporated a dash of the Savoy operas, was much more down-home.
I was down there in Savannah, starting to listen to cylindrical records and then Edison records, which were thick, about a half inch thick, weren't supposed to break when you dropped them. When I was about 3 years old, I can remember taking a trip down to Jacksonville and listening to one of those records of When It's Apple Blossom Time in Normandy, which was a big hit in the First World War. So I was born in 1909. That was must have been when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I always listened to records and began to sing the records that I heard, sang in the choir when I was 6 until I was about 18, learned a lot of Episcopal hymns, and when I got to be of drinking age and driving age, we sang a lot in the car, you know, we'd park the car and sing quartets and things. I just think I gravitated toward music. It was what I learned first, and what I was more interested in than anything else. I guess a lot of kids are, but I was lucky enough to make a little money at it.
In his autobiography, Mercer recalls the big songs of his infancy and boyhood, the songs that left an indelible impression on him. They were nothing surprising or unusual, just the songs that rural, small-town America sang to itself on the back porch and in the bars, on picnics, dances. Songs that were easy to remember, but so hard to forget, as a songwriter once said. They were most of them written by the journeyman craftsmen of the songwriting racket, men who did what they could and had no suspicion that what they were compiling was a sort of social history of America in song. Mercer's father, a successful lawyer and real estate man, had his favorite.
I wandered today to the hill, Maggie.
That was Robert White singing the favorite song of Johnny Mercer's father. As for his mother, she had Scott's family connections, which explains why the whole family was familiar, and by that I mean word perfect, with the repertoire of Harry Lauder. But for the most part, the vocal music was pure Americana. Now, it was a vital moment in the history of American popular music, a moment when the old was giving way to the new. George Cohan was being challenged as America's musical voice by the pseudo-ragtime of Irving Berlin's generation. America was beginning to find its own popular style, expressed in song-plugging parlors and theaters, on barroom pianos, and family sing-alongs.
Meet me tonight in dreamland, under the silvery moon. Meet me tonight in dreamland, where love's sweet roses bloom.
These songs and hundreds like them were the ones which Mercer digested in his childhood, and they stayed with him for the rest of his life. Being a staunch believer in the theory that the songs a nation sings are a sure guide to its character, Mercer had a deep affection for these songs and would have been rendered blissfully happy had you been able to convince him that his own work belonged in this pantheon of imperishable popularity? He wasn't quite sure. He once said to me that what he would like to have done just once was to have written a really big hit. The remark astonished me, but John, I said, you already have, dozens of times over. No, he said, I mean a really big hit. I asked him what he had in mind, and without hesitation, he quoted this song written just before he was born.
Hey, take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back, let me roll.
Two things happened to Johnny Mercer in his youth which settled the course of his life. His father failed in business, and he failed to become an actor. It was his father's financial collapse which caused him to go out into the outside world a little sooner than he might have done. And when he went to New York to become a famous actor, he soon realized that this was one dream that wasn't going to come true. So he improvised, and he sold the theater people something else.
I decided to go to New York and try and be an actor. I took these little press clippings and off I went. And I was in a couple of plays, and I worked between plays down in Wall Street, running errands, clipping coupons, doing whatever I had to do, whatever I could pick up, which wasn't much. And gradually began to write songs, which I had started when I was about 14 or 15 years old. More and more, and as the jobs got less and less, my songs got a little better. And when I finally tried to get a job in a musical comedy and couldn't get it as an actor, I sold him a song. And the song was in the show, and that kind of opened the door for me to Tin Pan Alley.
Mine's a hopeless case, but there's one saving grace. Anyone would feel as I do. Out of breath and scared to death of you. Love was first divined, then explored and defined. Still the old sensation is new. Out of breath and scared to death of you. It takes all the strength that I can call to my command to hold your hand. I would speak at length about the love that should be made, but I'm afraid. Hercules and such never bothered me much. All you have to do is say boo. I'm out of breath and scared to death of you.
That performance by Mercer of his first lyric tells us two more important things about the man. First, he was a natural lyric writer. Second, he was a born singer. All he needed was to find the kind of partner who could give him some encouragement. Mercer found two partners. One was his wife Ginger, who he met in the chorus of that show. The other was a songwriter senior to Mercer in years and success.
I was working with a fellow named Archie Blyer, who was an arranger, and a very prominent arranger. Later had his own record company and other things. And we wrote some songs together. He played for my audition when I auditioned for Paul Whiteman. And he had a friend named Eddie Woods, who worked in the stockroom of Southern Music, where Hoagie was under contract. And Eddie Woods, this guy in the stockroom, asked me one day, he said, how would you like to write with Hoagie Carmichael? He said, would you? I said, oh boy, would I? Could I meet him? I admired him as a record buff. So I met him, and we first wrote a song called Thanksgiving, about the holiday. Then we wrote a kind of a Indiana-type song called Down to Uncle Bill's, Down Among the Hills. Sort of James Whitcomb Riley song.
Come the first snappy weather, folks will get together down to Uncle Bill's, down among the hills. There'll be all kinds of cousins driving by the dozens down to Uncle Bill's, down among the hills.
He played me a song called Snowball that he had written. And in the verse it was like, your mama's little lazy bones. That was a phrase in the song. I said, gee, Hoagie, that's a good title. Could I use that for a title? He said, you think it'd be a good title? I said, I sure do. So he wrote a tune to it. And then I went home and tried to finish the lyric. It took me months and months. I got most of it. But the middle part, terribly difficult. I wasn't very technically skilled in those days. I learned a lot from Hoagie. But we finally got it done, and it was an instantaneous hit. Everybody sang it. And Hoagie was in Europe. He left to come over here to England to do a tour. And by the time he got back, it was the rage of America. It was a big, big hit.
long as there is chicken gravy on your rice, everything is nice. Long as there's a watermelon on the vine, everything is fine. You got no time to work, you got no time to play, busy doing nothing all the live long day. You won't ever change, no matter what I say. You just made that way. Get your day's work done, sleeping in the noonday sun. Lazy bones, sleeping in the shade. How you expect to get your cornmeal made? Never get your cornmeal made. Sleeping in the evening shade. When taters need spraying, I bet you keep praying bugs fall off of the vine. And when you go fishing, I bet you keep wishing the fish won't grab at your line. Whoa, lazy bones, loafing through the day. How you expect to make a dime that way? You will never make a dime that way. Well, look here. He never heard a word I say. Lazy, you old sleepy head. Nothing but lazy, lazy bones.
After Lazy Bones, I got a job with Paul Whiteman. On the strength of Lazy Bones, though, I always thought, because he could say, and here's the writer of Lazy Bones, and out comes this 20-year-old kid, you know, fresh out of the cotton fields, sing the song. And then when I was with the band, I began to write with other guys. I wrote a few songs with Matty Malnick, a little song called Pardon My Southern Accent. We made a record of a song called Fare Thee Well to Harlem, which I wrote with Bernie Hannigan, Dixieland Band, which I gave to Benny Goodman, P.S. I Love You, which I wrote with Gordon Jenkins. All these guys were writer-arrangers, writer-composer-arrangers, all around the music business, either fiddle players or saxophone players or something like that.
Mercer stayed with the Whiteman Band for a year, but by now he had discovered that he wasn't an actor. And although a useful singer, that wasn't his vocation either. He was a writer. And so he started to write. He wrote anything with anyone, including himself. And it so happened that his next hit read Words and Music by Johnny Mercer. By now he was learning that writing songs for a living was a hazardous game, and that you never knew where your next brickbat was coming from. Even Lazy Bones, an enormous hit that it was, did not have it all plain sailing. When it reached Germany, the local gangland boss, one Adolf Hitler, banned the song because he thought the words would encourage Germans not to go to work. Lunacy of a different kind came to Mercer in the wake of Lazy Bones. He went out to the great Dream Factory.
Somebody out in Hollywood heard me and asked me to come out and write a couple of pictures. So I went to Hollywood. This is 1935, and I wrote two flop pictures. I think they opened at the Tivoli on 8th Avenue. I don't know where they are.
By 1935, Mercer had registered in the consciousness of the professionals. By 1937, he was established as one of the brightest of the younger school of songwriters. But before that came a very curious episode when Mercer, failing to get a commission for a Shirley Temple picture, was suddenly at a loose end. The man who got the job for Miss Temple was Ted Kohler, and that meant that Kohler's partner, Rube Bloom, was also at a loose end. So, Mercer and Bloom got together to write a show for London. It was called Blackbirds of 1936, and when Mercer and Bloom pitched camp at the Savoy Hotel, they were dismayed to see that Lou Leslie, their impresario, became invisible every time money was mentioned. So Mercer and Bloom arranged to lose their inspiration. Leslie lost his nerve, and then he came across with some money, and magically songs began to pour out of the new team. Ginger later recalled sitting in the stalls during rehearsal and finding that one of the artists, one of the youngest virtuosi ever to star in London, was fast asleep in her arms. He was the younger of the two amazing Nicholas brothers.
I feel happy and I stay happy no matter what the season. There are all and none nice as they come and go.
Song was being appreciated by a London that was lost to history a long time ago. The summer of 1936, the abdication crisis, Schmeling KO's Joe Louis in 12, Arsenal win the FA Cup, appeasement becomes the policy of British governments, Rudyard Kipling dies, and millions flock to see Fred and Ginger. When Mercer and Bloom went home, the movie industry was at its peak. Every studio was pouring out musicals, and Hollywood had replaced Broadway as the heart of the songwriting industry. Mercer's first partner out there was again a much older man, Richard Whiting, who had been a writer of hits when Mercer was still a Savannah schoolboy. Mercer remembered Whiting as a practical joker, a gentle creature surrounded by an adoring family, but above all, as a man with a gift for a good tune. In 1937, Whiting and Mercer wrote songs for three pictures. Varsity Show was little more than a rerun of the college movie that Mercer had appeared in 3 years earlier. The second, Ready, Willing and Able, turned out to be a landmark in the career of both of them.
I search for phrases to sing your praises, but there aren't any magic adjectives to tell you all you are. You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous, that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they're just not swell enough. You're much too much. And just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
That version of Too Marvelous for Words, sung by the composer's daughter Margaret Whiting, is very good, but partial. Mercer was so prolific that once he had broken the code of a melody, he could go on writing verses indefinitely, each one cuter than the last.
You're much too much, and
just too very, very to ever be in Mr. Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
The third of the pictures with Whiting included something else just as distinguished in its way. A song whose lyric has a laugh at the expense of the very men who were employing him. If songs like There's No Business Like Show Business and That's Entertainment glorify the Broadway theatre, this would be Hollywood's answer, except that Mercer wrote this song long before the other songs were even thought of. The film Hollywood Hotel was a mindless mix-up involving Benny Goodman's band and a load of starlets.
Hooray for Hollywood, that screwy ballyhooey Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pant. And any barmaid can be a star maid if she dances with or without a fan. Hooray for Hollywood, where you're terrific if you're even good, where anyone at all from Shirley Temple to Amy Semple is equally understood. Go out and try your luck, you might be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood.
Chillicothe's and Paducah's with their bazookas to get their names up in lights, all armed with photos from local rodos with the hair and ribbon and legs in tights. Hooray for Hollywood. You may be homely in your neighborhood, but if you think that you can be an actor, see Mr. Factor. He'll make a monkey look good. Within a half an hour you'll look like Tyrone Power.
Richard Whiting, when he wrote the melody of that song, was very nearly at the end. Soon after he died, leaving Mercer with a new partner, although still at the same studio, Warner Brothers. Mercer grieved for Dick Whiting. He had loved him almost as a son loves a father. And in his autobiography, describes how in the afterglow of the big success of Too Marvelous, the pair of them sat around Whiting's pool, and this is Mercer's phrase, throwing rocks at the blackbirds. But there was another partner in the wings, one of Mercer's heroes. For some years, the partnership between Al Dubin and Harry Warren had sustained Warner Brothers through 42nd Street, Footlight Parade, Dames, Gold Diggers, and all sorts of other films. Now, Dubin was out, and they needed a new writer for Warren. Mercer was the man, and they set to write for Dick Powell. Again, there was instant success.
You must have been a beautiful baby. You must have been a wonderful child. When you were only starting to go to kindergarten, I bet you drove a little girls wild. When it came to winning blue ribbons, You must have shown the other kids how. I can see the judge's eyes as they handed you the prize. I'll bet you made the cutest bow. Oh, you must have been a beautiful baby, 'cause baby, look at you now. You must have been a beautiful baby. You must have been a wonderful child. When you were just starting to go to kindergarten, I'll bet you drove the little girls wild. When it came to winning blue ribbons, you must have shown the other kids how. I can see the judge's eyes as they handed you the prize. I bet you made the cutest bow. Oh, you must have been a beautiful baby, 'cause baby, look at you. Oh, baby, look at you. Oh, baby, look at you now. Oh, baby, look at you now.
Everyone recorded that one, but it wasn't quite the biggest success that Mercer and Warren enjoyed together. They did the songs for a picture called Going Places, in which Dick Powell poses as a jockey and as an actor, while Louis Armstrong plays the groom who can calm the great racehorse by singing and playing at it. The song for Louis was a famous example of Mercer's gift for plucking out of the small talk of the people the phrase that they could associate with.
Jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those beavers? Jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Oh gosh, I'll get them, had to get so lit up. Gosh, I'll get them, had to get that size. Oh golly gee, when you turn the heaters on, woe is me. Got to put my cheetahs on. Jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those peepers? Oh, those weepers, had to get my ties. Oh, where'd you get those eyes? Oh, jeebus, 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 creepers, where'd you get those peepers, boy? Jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Guys, all get up. I dig it so little. casual, get them boy, hot, get that size. Golly gee, oh, when you turn those heaters on, woe is me. Got to put my cheetahs on. Jeeba, 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 screen bunny, where'd you get those weebers, boy? Oh, those weebers, have they hypnotized, yes. Where'd you get those eyes?
By 1937, the year of Jeepers Creepers, everyone wanted to work with Johnny Mercer. Everything he was involved with seemed to have wit and a few memorable phrases. One day, his old associate from the London show, Rube Bloom, called him with a batch of songs.
That's true. I think he played me five or six songs. He had some melodies which he'd evidently been saving up, or maybe he'd just written them. But he hadn't played them for any other lyric writers. That is, he hadn't had any success with them. So he played me these tunes, and I picked those two out. I said, those are wonderful. Now, I can't write them right now, but if you write them with anybody else, I'll never talk to you again. So he saved them for me for two or three weeks when I got a little less busy, and I wrote those songs up within a month of each other.
Fools rushing where angels fear to tread. And so I come to you, my love, my heart above my head. Though I see the danger there, if there's a chance for me, then I don't care. Fools rushing where wise men never go. But wise men never fall in love, so how are they to know? When we met, I felt my life begin. Your heart and let this fool rush in. Felt my life begin. So open up your heart and let this fool rush in.
One of England's great 18th century poets had been Alexander Pope, who in a piece called Essay on Man had written the phrase, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Late in life, Mercer was to demonstrate the same trick to even more deadly effect, as we'll see. But for the moment, what about the second of Rube Bloom's two hits?
Day in, day out, the same old voodoo follows me about. The same old pounding in my heart whenever I think of you. And darling, I think of you day in and day out. Day out, day in. I needn't tell you how my days begin. When I awaken with a tingle, one possibility in view, that possibility of maybe seeing you. Come rain, come shine, I meet you and to me the day is fine. Then I kiss your lips and the pounding becomes the ocean's roar, a thousand drums. Can't you see it's love? Can there be any doubt when there it is, day in, day out? I meet you and to me the day is fine. Then I kiss your lips and the pounding becomes the ocean's roar, a thousand drums. Can't you see it's love? Can there be any doubt when there it is, day in, day out? Then I kiss your lips and the pounding becomes the ocean roar, and drums. Can you see his love? Can there be any doubt when there it is?
In 1939, someone else came to Mercer, not with songs, but with a suggestion that they create some, not for any specific occasion, just for the hell of it, to see what would happen. The man's name was James Van Heusen.
Well, it's quite a long time ago. I wrote it, I think when I was in New York in 1939 doing a Benny Goodman radio program. But I didn't write too many songs with Jimmy Van Heusen. It might have been earlier than that. It might have been before I went to Hollywood. That's quite an old song.
I took a trip on a train and I thought about you. I passed a shadowy lane and I thought about you. Two or three cars parked under the stars, a winding stream, moon shining down on some little town, and with each beam the same old dream. And every stop that we made, oh, I thought about you. When I pulled down the shade, then I really felt blue. I peeked through the crack and looked at the track, the one going back to you. And what did I do? I thought about you. Cars parked under the stars, winding stream, moon shining down on some little town, and with each beam the same old dream. And I looked at that track, one going back to you. And what did I do? I thought about you.
With I Thought About You, it could be said that Johnny Mercer's apprenticeship was over. He had worked with Hoagy Carmichael, Richard Whiting, Harry Warren, Jimmy Van Heusen, and achieved hits with every one of them. Now came the call for him to step up into history and collaborate with Jerome Kern himself. Mercer was filled with foreboding. Kern's reputation as a perfectionist was daunting. Next week, we'll find out if it daunted Mercer.
And that's it. See you same time next week.
You've been listening to In the Benny Green Archives here on lgradio.online. Please do visit the website to find out when the next episode is on, along with all our other shows. This is lgradio.online. Thanks for listening.